I'm Duane Schultes, and on this Vital Health podcast, I'm speaking to Christian Schneider, the Chief Medical Officer of Biopharma Excellence at Pharmalex. Christian was the Chief Scientific Officer of the UK's MHRA and the Medical Head for Licensing at the Danish Medicines Agency. He was also a member of the Committee for Medicinal Products for Human Use, the CHMP of the European Medicines Agency, as well as its head for the Committee of Advanced Therapies. Christian, always great to see you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, it's been a while.
It's been a while.
Yes. We're both a little grayer, but I think...
Especially me.
It's great to see you, and it's nice to be here in Denmark. Thank you for the opportunity to sit down and chat. You are a person who's had an enormous amount of regulatory experience, particularly for new science and new technology. And now you're actually working as a consultant, getting stuff in. You have knowledge on both sides of the equation, and you're a rare breed. How do you compare the two, the differences between working as a regulator and then working on the industry? What do you bring to the industry now as a former regulator? What surprised you, I guess?
Well, that is really a nice question. I think what surprised me is that the work is in many aspects not so much different, because basically, as a regulator, at least if you have that mindset as a regulator, you also want to have medicines on the market. Otherwise, you have no job to do. So you really want to be a permissive regulator. And at the time, we also published papers when I worked at, with the EMA colleagues on that regulators need to be enablers and not just gatekeepers. Of course, they need to be gatekeepers, but also enablers. But I think that gatekeeping role sometimes is necessary, but it creates a bit of problems. And now what really has surprised me or is an eye-opener is how difficult it is sometimes is for companies, especially small companies,
sure,
to be part of this and to fulfill all of these requirements. Of course, requirements are important and they can be helpful because you know what to do. But on the other hand, especially when it is a cutting-edge advanced therapy medicine product or a nanotechnology product or a combination product, a complex one, well, it's difficult because you don't know what the requirements are and which of the requirements actually you can and should fulfill. So that was an eye-opener for me, and as well as the cost related with this. So every question you ask as a regulator has an implicated cost at the side of the company who has to do it.
Increasingly, there's a lack of awareness on that cost. Or there's a belief that it's irrelevant, that the pharmaceutical industry is gratuitously profitable, when in fact, last year, the industry was net profitability 18%, which was slightly less than the coal mining industry. The reality is the profitability of the sector has been going down. Why do you think there's this disconnect between the reality of what regulators think and what's actually going on?
I think this is very likely because regulators are simply not trained for this. It depends on the particular CVs of the people being regulators. So some people actually are from industry. They are a rare breed as
sure.
Well. So being from industry, then going to be a regulator, that's happening. But I don't think this is many of them. They, of course, have a better eye for that. But then, of course, there is this responsibility that you have as a regulator. And you have to be very experienced to be able to where to draw the line, not to ask a question, not to have a requirement, because basically it is you not having asked that. So sometimes, especially when younger reviewers are trained up, they would have a tendency to ask more questions. And I understand them. I was in their shoes as well. But with hindsight, when I was in the job for 10 years, I realized some of the questions I asked to companies may not have been necessary. They were not stupid to ask. But of course, you could have taken a bit more of a risk-based approach. And actually, that is one of the magical words that also found its way into how guidelines are written, into how legislation is written now, that basically is a more adapted approach, I would think.
And a lot of that came from European Medicines Agency's Hans Georg Eichler, the chief science officer. He really pushed for a lot of that open-mindedness.
Yeah.
What was an acceptable risk level for... What was the term he used to use?
Effectiveness gap?
The efficacy-effectiveness gap. Exactly.
Yeah.
And that was always something that Hans Georg really drilled into and was very, very perceptive on, I thought.
And there were a number of very nice papers, actually, that he wrote. So not only did he pioneer the idea that there could be something like adaptive licensing, which I think for several reasons didn't come to fruition, unfortunately. But basically, this magical turn, if the CHMP gives a positive opinion and the commission then authorizes a medicine tomorrow, today you would not be able to get it as a patient.
Right.
But tomorrow you would. So what happened overnight?
That magic moment.
It's the magic moment. Yeah, exactly. So this is a continuous process. And I think it was very right for him to pinpoint that. And also the new technologies that are coming up, signal detection in pharmacovigilance, very, very, very recent now with artificial intelligence, where, of course, there might be larger data sets being analyzed. And so there could be new signals coming up. And I remember still almost the words, it would be surprising if these new technologies would not yield in new signals. But we have to know what these actually mean. We have to interpret them. And there is a trap for a regulator there as well. If you act, you might overact on them, especially if it's a vaccine, for example.
Sure.
Remember a case for a vaccine where there was an adventitious agent found in it. It was authorized, been given to millions of children, was a rotavirus vaccine, a harmless thing. But if you don't act, of course, then you fall into the credibility trap because you haven't acted on it. So it's almost like a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation.
I have to say, one of the great successes you had, given your rather enlightened perspective, Christian, while you were at the MHRA, was developing the UK's accelerated approval pathway. We're talking about novel approaches to regulation. How did this happen, and why do you think this revised pathway was needed?
Yeah, so this was a real privilege to lead that team at the MHRA. It's now called ILAP, Innovative Licensing and Access Pathway. Why this happened was because the UK, after Brexit, had the opportunity, but also the need to have a self-standing offer to industry. When you are in the European system, you can sometimes see that there are a lot of incentives, but for good reasons, they are limited. So for example, the certification procedure, which is the only data assessment procedure before authorization, is only available for advanced therapy medicinal products, so gene and cell therapies, and only for small and medium-sized enterprises, SMEs. But that could be a useful tool also for a novel monoclonal antibody, for example, or for a monoclonal antibody conjugate made by a big industry player. So why not have a certification procedure there? So scientific advice is more of a reactive type of interaction. The regulator will advise you on the concept, but they will not look at the data. But certification is really assessing data early in the development and giving you a regulatory stamp on it. I volunteered almost. I said, well, if we want to have such a pathway, I would be more than happy to lead a team. But I need the best people within MHRA from all areas. And they locked us in a room. It was just before the pandemic. It was really nice. It was before the pandemic. It was in the Canary Wharf offices with a lot of cookies. I still remember that. And then we had huge empty whiteboards. And we said, okay, if we want to take a best of all procedures that we have, how would this look like? And then we put everything on there. We discussed the pros and cons. We had the inspectors there who said, well, it's not just the quality of the food that we have to look at, but also the kitchen. You can have very good food made in a bad kitchen and other way around. So it's also the quality of the data, not just the quality data that we are looking at, for example. So basically, we formed that team and then we discussed that. And that kind of best of licensing then led to this, that basically companies are doing a target product profile when they design their product early in development. But as regulators, we would know how to regulate these, what the pitfalls are, because we've seen similar products, for example. We would know how a target regulatory profile would look like, a target development profile. So why should the regulator not be more proactive and also create in parallel on the regulatory side for a product that qualifies for such a procedure, something that helps the company basically alongside?
And theoretically helps the patients too with earlier access to a novel and effective treatment.
Indeed. And MHRA is actually a very patient-centric authority, you could say. So they have a patient committee, they have a lot of patient engagement, patient network. So indeed, the voice of the patient is so important. I remember a discussion in the CHMP where patients were heard and asked about the risk that they would be willing to accept about a particular adverse event. And interestingly, the level of risk they were ready to accept was 10 times higher than the regulators or the physicians would have accepted.
That's interesting. And how did that get quantified?
That was a publication. That was a survey.
And this is one of the concerns right now about the desire to put quality in around some metrics in the United States. They don't actually use the patient's perspective. It's people who are outside who aren't actually directly impacted by the disease. They always require third parties. And this really has a tendency, we think, to bias the result.
I'm a medical doctor by background. You know that there is the patient, but there is also the relatives and the family environment, the everyday. And sometimes when we talk about endpoints and scales, is a 0.5 improvement on scale XYZ actually clinically meaningful? You have to hear the patient what that actually means for them. There was once a discussion where a patient it was an eye disease of inborn blindness. And the patient then said, this basically means for me that I don't need help. I can make my coffee in the morning myself. That small thing, seemingly small thing, means a lot to a person.
And of course,
when you're a regulator or a developer or whatever you are, you're normally a healthy person, so to speak. Well, kind of healthy, but you would not necessarily suffer from that disease and not necessarily understand what the disease actually means.
One of the challenges we have in Europe now is data availability. The GDPR increasingly is seen as a real impediment. Is that a problem right now, the data protection?
Yes and no. Of course, it is there for a good reason. I mean,
Sure. Every
legislation is there for a good reason to protect patients. I think the problem is where a legislation is implemented and not all implications, naturally so maybe, can be assessed right from the start. So for example, there's numerous examples where legislations like advanced therapies, for example, the definition of what it is was implemented, and then later, a couple of years later, you realize that for medicines like gene editing technologies, some requirements don't make sense.
Yeah.
But of course they can't, because you can't prospectively see what problems are ahead down the road. And maybe it's the same here. And I think it may require a more targeted approach by companies to request more data than actually is foreseeable in the beginning of a clinical trial, so that basically they are more flexible in what data they get.
If we look at this from the context of clinical trials, we see that Asia's poised to overtake Europe as a clinical trial location. From your standpoint, why do you think this is occurring?
I think this could have, of course, many reasons. I think one important one will be cost. So the cost of clinical trials has increased a lot. And also requirements have increased a lot. I still remember a publication. It was in the golden times of regulatory science when Hans-Georg Eichler also published his seminal papers, at least some of them, where there was a publication that basically the productivity goes down. In processor technology, we have Moore's Law. So in pharmaceutical industry, it's almost other way around, Earum's Law.
Yeah, that's Jack Scannell.
Yeah, indeed.
Exactly.
It's that publication. So that's quite some time ago. But it's at that time, there was a publication as well, which showed how much the requirements for clinical trials actually increased. And I'm not pointing my finger, because obviously there is, again, very often a good reason for doing so. And I'm not saying that in Asia the requirements are lower. I'm not saying that it's more lenient there. But of course, there might be something to this, that it's a combination of the requirements, but also the costs related to clinical trials. And that the approval process of clinical trials now with a new clinical trial regulation may or may not improve with a leading country doing this. But of course, you will have to negotiate certain requirements with the national authorities as well, depending on what product you have. So especially if it is a cutting-edge product, maybe a genetically modified organism, that can be quite a nightmare to do, especially with the GMO regulations, which are nationally different in Europe. There might be also incentives, certain incentives. So some regions actually are especially trying to attract early clinical trials, especially. Early clinical trials is actually a good thing to have. It's not putting patients at danger necessarily because it's dangerous new drugs coming in. It gives patients access to cutting-edge medicines because there's a high promise as well with them. So of course, that also will play a certain role. So for example, it's not Asia, but Australia, I think, is very keen to have early clinical trials in Australia.
So we're seeing pressure on Europe from a clinical trial perspective. In 1980, Europe was producing about 60% of the globe's pharmaceutical products. That now is around 20%, according to literature. In our data, we find that only 15% of the type 1 novel new therapies approved by the FDA actually were developed in Europe. What role do you think a change in the pharmaceutical legislation like the GPL or also some of the clinical trial enhancements that you just brought up, what role can that play?
So, of course, first of all, a decline in clinical trials and innovation can have many reasons.
Sure.
And this is, for example, so innovation often happens with small companies, university spin-offs. It you need to have the talent sitting. And of course, in the US, there is a lot of universities. There is a lot of incentives, a lot of money in the system. There is also incentives in Europe. But of course, this is a bit of a moving target. And fostering of innovation is a balance of at least these two factors, incentives and funding. But it is true that the regulator and the framework has a big role to play. And of and FDA has implemented a program, a very successful program, I think, of early interaction possibilities, interact meetings, for example.
Sure.
Europe has that as well. But the European Medicines Agency, I think, needs a more informal way of interacting as well. So scientific advice is quite formal, and it is good that it is, and it is fine that it is. They have innovation task force meetings. But I think they might want to have something more formal, informal, so to speak,
sure,
implemented that companies can actually use in order to interact with the regulator from early on. Because I think that this is a very important item. There is scientific advice, but there also needs to be regulatory input. And I think that the regulator also needs to take certain items in, like what you say, the practical implications of regulations like GDPR, for example. What does that mean? Sometimes the legislators wouldn't know because they will not have seen the practical issues. And then, of course, a revision of the legislation is a good opportunity to maybe correct some of these items. I'm speaking in general terms now.
Sure.
Or maybe to give certain other incentives when they see that innovation is actually going down. So the pharma review that we are currently seeing, actually one of the aims of that is to foster innovation in the European Union.
And do you think it will?
I think there's a good chance that it will. Of course, there is a number of items in there like data protection and the redefinition of unmet medical need and other items, which we will have to see how they pan out. I hope that it actually does, because at least streamlining the regulatory processes, giving more leeway and maybe more breathing space to the European Medicines Agency might actually be a good thing, so that they can implement something, maybe redirect money from certain resources that are very costly now to other resources that then they can maybe increase, like the interaction with companies. I would really welcome if they could do that.
There's political need, and then there's economic reality, unfortunately. Not to be overly cynical, but I think we're getting to a point in politics now where we've got a class of politicians who have one thing, which is more government and more regulation and more oversight, and they just keep twisting that dial. And the problem is when things don't work, it's like, well, obviously we didn't do this enough, and they just kind of keep twisting the dial. We've lost sight of the fact that there are economic realities that you must deal with.
Yeah.
And we're just trying to say, well, we can regulate everything and government can control everything. It's like, no, I mean, you can try, and certainly you need oversight if there's a disequilibrium or something's wrong, but you can't fix everything.
And there's a regulatory mindset. At least when I was a regulator in the beginning, I had that. And I think this is a natural evolution in thinking. I thought that I'm responsible for everything and that I need to control everything.
Right.
So to speak. So basically, I need to ask that question. I need even more questions and that question. And But sometimes you don't realize what it means in practical terms, also in terms of cost.
What, you mean costs are irrelevant, Christian? What are you saying?
I mean regulators, they don't even take into account costs because they would otherwise not authorize expensive medicines. But the flip side is they need to be aware of what requirements actually mean for the cost of the development. And I don't think they know.
I think it's gotten to the point where I don't want to say they don't care, but I think there's a belief that it doesn't matter, if that makes sense, because the industry will always be profitable, which I think is a huge mistake.
Yeah. I think this is a common belief that they are earning enough money with this, especially later. But for some medicines, actually, that's not the case.
It's certainly not an orphan drug.
No, no, not at all.
Picking up on that idea, if we look at the evolution now of what's occurred between EMA and FDA, we see on average a 6-month delay between EMA and FDA. And part of the reason for that is it's just taking longer for the reviews to occur in EMA. Now, what's intriguing is if you go back before the centralized procedure in 2004, we saw some incredibly early approvals. Zocor was approved in Europe 3 years before it was approved by FDA. The mutual recognition before allowed a very fast approval. Have we lost something about this idea that the member states of the EU had skin in the game about clinical approvals, particularly working very closely with the clinicians? Do we have a problem now that that's sort of been removed from the process?
It is an interesting one, because if an approval is 3 years earlier in Europe than in the US, then that is a decision made by the pharmaceutical developer to apply in Europe first, for whatever reason, which I don't know, which I can't comment on. We have seen indeed before the centralized approvals some very fast approvals, but also some very slow approvals.
The variance was much, much larger. There's 100% true on that.
And we have seen no approvals in some of the smaller member states. So I think the centralized procedure actually gives access, equitable access to all patients in the European Union. That is the spirit of it, that basically you have one approval procedure and then it is authorized, not yet marketed. We might come back to that little difference, but authorized in all member states. And I think what we have to look at is when something is authorized relative to FDA and how long the approval timeline is. Because I think the 6 months is more a comparison of the approval timeline. So if FDA start on 1st of January and EMA starts to review on 1st of January, who will be faster? And that is, of course, difficult to foresee. That I wouldn't say that Europe is slower than FDA. But of course, the European system, the way it is made is that you've got two rapporteurs and you've got the member states, the CHMP members and their teams commenting on this. And I was a rapporteur myself. I was a reviewer myself.
You were also a chair in advanced therapies, too.
Yes, indeed. I was chair of the Committee for Advanced Therapies. Well, of course, I had an interest that the lists of questions going out to companies would be balanced and feasible and doable for them. And I'm not saying that they aren't, but I did a little analysis at the time, which never published because it's confidential data and also a bit contentious data at that time at least. And you could see that there was a certain trend, small number of products, but still a certain trend. The more complex the product is, the more questions were asked. It's almost a trivial finding because, of course, the more complex it is, you will have questions.
But yeah, I mean, it's somewhat axiomatic, but I think it's illustrative of a larger point, right? That the more complex it is, the more delays and the more barriers there are going to be to getting an approval.
Indeed, that is exactly the point, because the more complex a product is, the higher the risk might be. And that means that this is more often developed by smaller companies. So especially those stakeholders who do not have the resource to answer 200 questions within 3 months of clock stop actually get long lists. And that is not necessarily a bad thing from a regulatory perspective, because we need to ask questions, they are important. But I think this is indeed what we discussed in the very beginning, would have to balance what is the added value of me knowing that against me not knowing that, and thus is it relevant for approval. And I'm not at all pointing my finger now at the approval process in Europe, because with the peer review process that's been implemented, that has improved a lot. But of course, still there is a lot of negotiation and rework of the questions that you have to do, and also during the process. So the process might therefore take a bit of time. And we have seen some cases where there was prolonged clock stops and so on, which of course makes the procedure longer.
I think you make a really interesting point that it's often the smallest companies with the most innovative products that are the ones that are going to be the most challenged by a lot more questions, particularly if they're going through a clinical trial that's quite complex or has very complex endpoints or a novel mechanism of action. I just look at some of the challenges around the CAR T therapeutics that we did a lot of work on. Those were frightfully difficult. It was not even so much a drug as it is a supply chain. It's a very, very complex operation. If we're losing the clinical trial edge in Europe, if that's dropping, are we getting a skills gap in clinical trials?
I don't think we do, because still Europe is an important region. So most clients I'm working with, they are targeting Europe as well. Maybe not always at the same time as the US, depending on the company size, the strategy, and a lot of other factors. But this is one of the strengths of the European system, that you have a very large pool of experts in the European database, and there will always be an expert in a certain topic. The teams, they can be put together in a multinational, multidisciplinary way at EMA. And I've always found this one of the particular strengths in the system. And what I said before, that it might take longer, that was not at all meant as a criticism and that there are so many questions. That sounds a bit as if I'm criticizing my former colleagues. I'm not, because basically the upside of that is that you really have looked at everything, and that enables the company also to further develop and deepen the product later. But of course, there has to be that trade-off of when it is too much and when it is too little. So coming back to your question, I don't think we are there yet that we would see a drop in experience and expertise. And the EMA has recently, well, not so recently, but still kind of recently, published their regulatory science strategy, where especially complex clinical trials, new methodology, is actively spelled out as well. And I think that step that we have to take now on all sides, especially also on the regulatory side, is to do it. To take the step and say, okay, these are really, really complex methodologies where the clinicians, including myself here, may not always understand all methodological aspects, and the statisticians and methodologists will have discussions that are not easy to follow. But we have to take that step and accept this methodology as the evidence generator. Because it is always good to put into a strategy to say, well, we will foster complex clinical trials and so on. But then we don't dare assessing them. I'm not saying that Europe doesn't and others don't. But I think this is the step that we have to take.
I think it's one thing to say it. It's another thing to make it real. I think that's the problem.
That's it. That's indeed the point. And I think they are on a very good trajectory here. But they need to continue doing that.
What about some of the challenges now of drug-device combinations? If we look at, say, let's look at the new Alzheimer's treatments that are coming, the monoclonal antibody injectables for amyloid beta plaques. Obviously, highly effective, 30% reduction in cognitive decline, fantastic, wonderful. But the reality is, we have seen some toxicity. This requires integrated PET scans, MRIs. This is not easy. We know there's a lack of MRIs and available technology in Europe. And this is just the first of what will certainly be many that has a heavy imaging component. How are we going to deal with that in Europe?
Yeah, so there's a number of items in this. So first, it is the assessment, the regulatory assessment, but it is also how to authorize this and how much guidance, or should we say requirements, we are giving in the summary of product characteristics. So basically that is what is steering the physician to do. So if you, for example, say that this medicine needs to be under the authority or supervision of a trained neurologist with ready access to regular MRI, of course you're already restricting this.
And you're making the assumption that it's available.
And you're making the assumption that it is available. So you might disadvantage certain regions. It is a conservative approach because you will be able to control it. But the question is, how much would the data generated already in the clinical trial at the time of approval allow you to maybe have not so frequent assessments in patients and maybe do this clinically? So this is, I think, the practical aspect that has to go into this. And coming back to your question about device and drug combinations, I think that's an interesting one because the medicines regulators will have a lot of experience with the medicines, but not with the device components. And device regulators will have a lot of experience with the device component, but not with the medicines.
Yeah, exactly.
So they would have to interact.
And often the regulatory timelines are completely different.
They're
as well.
Different, indeed. And you would have to have at least some expertise which is able to assess exactly the line where both components meet. So in the Committee for Advanced Therapies at EMA, where you might have complex cell-based products in a device 3D matrix, I was glad that we had one or two experts who actually were experts with medical devices who could then actually say something about these things. So not just discussing the cells, but also discussing the matrix component. And it's the same here for complex technologies which apply a certain medicine into the brain, for example. How does that interact? And it leads to so many different aspects where we could talk for hours. Also the design of clinical trials.
I've got a lot of tape, Christian. I got a lot of tape.
So there's a lot to this, actually.
How much of this are you directly involved with now with your current work at Biopharma Excellence and PharmaLex? How much of this are you doing?
So indeed, we are quite involved with this because we do see drug-device combinations. Fortunately, we do have a device team who are very skilled both in the assessing the delivery devices, but also integrated devices. And when you work in a company, of course, it is easy to discuss and easy to interact because there is no barriers. We can just put the teams together and then work. So we are actually working on this, and we do see, I can't say yet if this is a trend, but we do see an increasing number of clients where this is actually requested and where we are actively discussing that.
This is going to be an increasing problem. We're going to see novel combo therapies that require some sort of monitoring given the risk assessment. We are going to see increasing challenges here.
Indeed, and that starts as early as the clinical trial. We all remember that publication of, I think it was a Parkinson's trial in the pioneer years of gene therapy, where the control group, which was basically an implant in itself without any gene therapy in it, also had an effect.
Interesting.
That's, of course, not placebo necessarily, but that could be a local inflammation which is repaired and that has a collateral effect or whatever it is. We don't know. But it is not trivial. Sometimes people saying it's unethical to put a device into a patient without an active treatment. That's too easy to say because we need to be sure that the active drug component also has an effect, actually. So this is not easy to design such a trial and would have to interact with the regulators what their requirements are.
Under the current regulation, there's a desire to stratify your ability to be both in the market for a period of time and also obtain reimbursement based upon a regulatory decision of what is unmet medical need by innovation. Right now, it's, is there a drug for this or not? There's also, under the unmet medical need, the lowest barrier. I think it's only, you only get 5 years of data protection, but there's a real limit on if it's a drug that gets repurposed. And I always think of Viagra that got repurposed for peripheral arterial hypertension, which is a really terrible disease that has a very high mortality rate. What do you think is going to happen if this stays in its current structure, putting a 5-year difference between low and high unmet medical need, or regulatory decision on what's unmet need without really considering the availability of a therapeutic?
This is indeed an interesting question, which reminds me, just as a side note, on another nice regulatory science publication some years ago where certain diseases we are suffering from, and that is the better than the Beatles syndrome.
Yeah, that's also Jack Scannell.
Yeah, indeed. So we think that every new drug has to be, it's like a new album from a band has to be better than the white album from the Beatles, which is unachievable. So how much effect do we actually want for a new medicine? And I see a certain danger that some drugs in very difficult to treat diseases will have only an incremental increase in efficacy. Still, they need to be authorized because 10 years further down the line, there will be another medicine coming which might be synergistic with this one and then boost efficacy in combination. And if we never authorize this, we will never see that. You see what I mean?
So, oh, yeah, totally. But I mean, if look at Sovosevir, Sovaldi. You had pegylated interferon. You had all these things. And then finally, oh, wow, we got this.
Yeah.
99% cure. Now, pegylated interferon was only a 49% cure.
Yeah.
Lipitor is another one. That was the fifth or sixth lipid-lowering treatment that came onto the market. And without that iterative process, you don't have the ability to get there.
And I'm saying this because the wording in this proposal that a medicine product results in a meaningful reduction in disease morbidity or mortality. Now, when we look at authorization, and if something needs to get the stamp of high unmet medical need, we will have efficacy data. But as you say, what is meaningful?
Quotes.
This is exactly the problem, and it will depend on how permissive or not permissive one wants to be. Of course, we want to not have medicines which would cost a lot, and where there is only a small benefit. But we need to look at this bigger picture, and of course, the current definition has a certain attractivity because it is independent of the efficacy of the medicine. Early in development, you will not know yet what the effect is. So if you want to have a designation of unmet medical need for whatever reason early enough, for example, to get access to a certain incentive, then you will not have the data or you will have to generate the data. So basically, the meaningfulness will have to be implemented somehow in this development program already from earlier on. And in the classical paradigm, we've got a phase one trial, safety and tolerability. Phase two is the activity, but not yet the benefit. Phase three is the benefit to the patient. Then this activity endpoint early in development will maybe have to be boosted, so to speak, by putting something in which gives us more information about the benefit.
But that also then increases cost, that increases risk.
Yeah.
Investors are going to get cold feet because that's increasing their risk. That's sort of like putting a tax on the clinical trial on someone.
Yeah. Or it has an interesting knock-on effect on the regulators. There's a certain trend, there's a clear trend I see with companies actually rather wanting to have approval with a phase two trial.
Yeah, of course.
Where we say, listen, if you have the classical endpoints for activity, you can have a very active drug, a classic exaggerated example is a new monoclonal antibody in cancer. You've got a response rate, that is activity, a response rate of 99%, but after a month, all patients die. So the endpoint is met, it's active, but there's no benefit to the patients. So you've got to have a benefit endpoint in this. And if you implement this, which you can with certain endpoints that are correlating and so on, you can do this. But then, of course, companies would also think that we can ask for an approval because now we have a high unmet medical need situation. We've got a benefit endpoint. We've implemented this early in order to be able to show that, to get certain incentives. So then we want approval. So that might be a certain trend towards less evidence. Maybe this is a bit too far out of what I'm saying, but I could well imagine that this has some knock-on effects also on what companies would want to do with the data that they're actually generating in order to show that second part of the paragraph.
The problem, though, is that if a drug has efficacy, but the effectiveness is not as good as a current drug, that everyone's always going to buy the more expensive new drug and they're not going to ignore it. But we have numerous examples of very even effective drugs that were marginal improvements, even incremental improvements. I think of PCSK9 lipid-lowering injectables that ended up being in direct competition with a generic Lipitor. So even though PCSK9 had 20% better efficacy, it was a marketing failure because the incremental benefit of 20% compared to free Lipitor was not valued in the market for $15,000, which was the initial price. So even though it was a little better, it was a marketing failure. And we have numerous cancer drugs that show a little bit of a benefit. Yeah, we show tumor reduction, but yeah, in the end, it's not worth the extra price. And then they fall off. They're pulled out of the market. The last time we checked accelerated approvals in oncology, a lot of those drugs that are marginal fall off. Opdivo, Keytruda, and Gleevec have over half of all accelerated approvals right now in the U.S. And there's a reason why they're all highly effective treatments.
And of course, that puts a necessity, but also the opportunity to clinicians then to perform clinical trials with those drugs, which only give an incremental increase in new combinations, because that is what we need. Because we might find actually quite some surprising synergy with some of the of the medicines now approved. And that is more what investigators would do. Actually, it implies a bit what you said, that basically they got the first hurdle, the approval by the regulator. But maybe with putting efficacy to the definition of unmet medical need, that might also change, as we said. And there are different regulatory mindsets, I would say. Some regulators would say we only want to approve as gatekeepers those medicines which actually make a clear difference, and not someone, so to speak, getting a piece of the cake with something that is not at all better with what we have. But the other mindset is to say that physicians need more options. There is always a patient who cannot get, for tolerability reasons or whatever reasons, the currently approved medicine and needs an alternative. The more options you have as a physician, the better it is. So you would want to approve that as a regulator.
It's a competing interest. And the problem is, the more barriers you put up, it just creates uncertainty.
Yeah.
Oh, we're going to lose 2 years of data protection if we go into Europe with this, because all of a sudden we got a lower unmet medical need. Your investors are going to go, what the heck? Wow, my NPV just went out the window.
Mm.
And that's the problem. We're creating more uncertainty in an area where Europe actually needs to be more competitive.
I mean, of course, I hope it is right what is written somewhere in the text of this proposal, that the incentive is still competitive as compared to what others are offering. I haven't checked that.
Yeah.
But we would, of course, hope that this is the case. I can see where they're coming from, that they basically want to put a bit more an active burden on industry in order to kind of run for this. Because what we haven't seen is, for example, for some of the medicines that are on the market, new indications. When you talk to industry people some years ago, they said, why would we do this? Because we get only, was it an additional year of exclusivity? And yeah, we run a huge clinical trial. And that costs us so much that this additional year of exclusivity actually doesn't help us, because then generic competition or the biosimilar will also get that. And this is why it's not attractive. And that, of course, was an eye-opener for me when I heard that, because basically you want to have new indications for a medicine. You want to have an active life cycle and increasing access to patients. And this is why some monoclonals, for example, are used effectively in some indications, but they are not authorized in these because there is no application by the marketing authorization holder to actually go for that.
And this gets to one of the challenges that we see in the new general pharmaceutical legislation, the GPL, the proposal to cut back 2 years of data protection. And then if you do, say, a comparative effectiveness trial in all 27 member states, which is going to be a hugely expensive outcomes trial, you might get the 2 years back. Great, thank you. Is this going to have the impact that the commission thinks it's going to have? Do you honestly see some of the small companies that you're working with rolling the dice and then trying to hit some of these targets to get that 2 years back? Or is it just going to be, well, we're only going to get 8 years?
Well, I think this is going to be a cumbersome approach. I think the companies will not be able to do this without external help, I would say. I think the question is, in the practical approach, what they would have to do for that, what the milestone is that they have to hit. If they have to negotiate with all of the health technology assessment bodies in the member states within 2 years,
that's a heavy lift.
That's quite a heavy lift to do. And also what the outcome, if it already needs to be negotiated or not. I think that this could be difficult. But when I read this, I had the same thought. How are you going to do this, and how much is this going to cost you? But of course, I can fully understand why the commission has put this, because basically this is what we want to have. We want to not only cherry-picked large healthcare systems where the product is marketed and the smaller countries would not get access. That is, I think, a problem. But the question is how we reach this. Maybe this helps. Maybe this is adapted. Maybe there have been comments along these lines that the commission would want to reconsider this. I'm not saying that they should. This is really beyond me to say that. But at least the practical aspects, I think, need to be assessed. But also, I'm looking forward to a more harmonized approach with health technology assessment in Europe, because I think this is really something that is important.
Does Europe do itself any favors, given what we've seen with the drop in clinical trials and the general drop in the invention of new drugs and the origination of new therapies?
I think it depends on the medicine, the indication, sure. the market size. It's 2 years is quite some time, but I think for some medicines, I'm not sure it will be worth the effort.
You served on the CHMP. I'm sure you are aware of comments from some of your colleagues from some of the smaller Eastern Ascension countries. We can't put this novel oncology product in. We just don't even have the ability to measure it, to evaluate it from an HTA perspective. Are we getting ourselves into a situation where a lot of the countries aren't going to want to have a lot of these therapeutics?
Maybe. I mean, there is, if I'm not mistaken, there is the possibility for a country to waive that assessment. And I would hope that a waiver given would also count as positive into this. And the commission also writes in this, if I remember it correctly, and I think it is, that it would not indicate a lack of interest in that particular medicine. But I think these practical aspects in some of the member states, I think, are very important. Because you would, from an ideal world perspective, think that all countries want immediate access and they would, of course, be permissive to a new medicine coming in. But there are so many different national factors in this. And affordability is one of them, but not the only one of them, that have to be taken into account. And that might make it very, very difficult. But of course, on the other hand, it is always the same pattern, I would think. This is why I said maybe external help is needed then, because you don't have to reinvent the wheel. If you know what the requirements in member state X, Y, and Z are, they will be the same for the next medicine and for the one after this. You could maybe streamline this a bit more. But that is difficult to foresee.
Because health is still going to be a member state competence. That is not going to change. I don't see any appetite for a lot of the countries to surrender their control of their healthcare system as of today. I just don't.
That is correct. And I think they can't. I understand why. Because it is so expensive. If they don't have to control themselves and have someone else control it, with maybe a different set of principles, it might actually not at all be compatible with a particular health system and do more harm than good.
Christian, you've been on both sides. You're seeing the current situation in Europe, both from a regulator's eyes as well as a consultant. If you could make one recommendation right now to your former colleagues at the European Commission and the EMA regarding the current legislative proposals, what would it be? If you had one thing that you think would be the best thing to focus on?
I think the one thing that they should do is, and I'm sure that they're doing this, but I think they need to do this very, 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 very carefully and in depth. They need to do an impact assessment of these proposals. Because, of course, it is good to foster innovation, to streamline processes, but I think they have to think through the knock-on effects just along the lines that we have just discussed. And I think that a system based on incentives is an important one. I read that they have consulted, but also had several options on the table. And industry was in favor of having rather more incentives. And of course, that sounds a bit cheeky because they want even more incentives and they're earning already a lot of money with this. But in reality, an incentive is a good thing to have because that would be a positive thing to follow rather than trying to take something away and then get to the current status quo by doing even more things, because that will have a knock-on effect. And there will always be companies, especially smaller ones, who will not be able to live up to this. And I think that a differentiation also for smaller companies and larger companies, which they had with putting incentives for SMEs and so on, I think is very, very important in this. They must not leave this out of sight, especially higher risk but higher promise products might sometimes come from there. So this is a complex environment, and I think that this has to be looked at very, 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 very carefully. So an impact assessment, I think, is what I would wish for and I would recommend.
Christian Schneider, Chief Medical Officer of Biopharma Excellence at PharmaLex. Christian, always great to see you, sir. I'm sure we could talk for several hours more.
Would be a pleasure.
And we may over lunch. Thanks, Christian.
Thank you so much, Dwayne.
This Vital Health podcast was made possible with the support of the European Pharmaceutical Industries and Associations, EFPIA. The executive producer of the Vital Health podcast is Dwayne Schultes. Our editor is Mark Brodeen. Our project manager is Gwen O'Loughlin. The Vital Health Podcast is a production of Vital Transformation, LLC, copyright 2023.